This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Richard Price has written several novels which have been adapted into films, including Clockers, about crack dealers and cops, and The Wanderers, about street gangs in the Bronx, where Price grew up. Price also wrote the screenplays for the films Sea of Love, Mad Dog and Glory, and The Color of Money. More recently, he's written a number of episodes for the HBO series The Wire. His latest novel, Samaritan, comes out in paperback next week. It's about a guy who, like Price, grew up in a housing project and became a successful writer. The character in the novel, Ray Mitchell, has made a lot of money in L.A. writing for TV. After September 11th, Ray returns to New Jersey to be near his daughter. He also returns to his old neighborhood in the hopes of sharing some of his success by teaching at his former high school. Terry spoke with Richard Price last year. He began with an excerpt from Samaritan. Ray is teaching his first creative writing class, trying to convince a room of skeptical kids they each have stories to tell, and he's beginning to think that this teaching thing just might work.
This is great, great. Okay, this class, forget it, okay? Don't even think of it as creative writing. It's just stories. The writing assignments, stories, telling stories. Can somebody wake this guy up? One of the girls punched the boy, Jamal, whose forehead was resting on the table. Ray, so happy now, stories his lifelong lifeline, to his daughter, to romance, to himself. Stories the ballast, the crash cart, the air. And the thing is, what are you, Hopewell Projects kids? Neighborhood kids? Oh man, nobody out there knows what you know. And what you may think of as everyday, as boring, that's like, nah, that's me. When I want to read something, a book, a story, a newspaper article, I'm thinking, time is tight. Why should I read this? What does this individual have to tell me that I don't already know? He then checked himself, something off in the message. Not that what you write has to be a showstopper, mind-boggling, or, you know, can you top this? All I am saying is, believe me, you're all so much more interesting, so much more special than you might think. So every week, you're going to write me a few pages. Doesn't have to have a beginning or an end. Just some kind of snapshot, word picture. Bring it in and read it to the class, or I'll read it for you and we'll talk. Questions? Jamal, the sleeper, raised his hand. Does spelling count? The girl with the big framed glasses, Myra, clucked her tongue in irritation. Spelling is good. It's good to have spelling. His disappointment in the question was neutralized by this Myra. Something cooking there. Can we write in pencil? Pencil, pen, blood, as long as I can decipher it. Do they have to be true? Fool me.
Richard Price, do you think that this was a good lesson that he was delivering?
Worked for me.
Yeah, I figured.
I mean, you have. That's
you
how I
it?
Started. You know, I mean, you start writing, you know, and you look around at your life, and mm-hmm. you're 18, and the whole idea of write about what you know can be deadly for somebody who doesn't even vote yet. So what worked for me, and I think what worked for some of my students over the years, was reaching back into the family mythology and not being, you know, focused on the fact that all you know is that you miss your girlfriend over Thanksgiving vacation and you hate being with your parents.
One of the things Ray is up against as a teacher is that the kids are giving him these kind of prepackaged stories. Talk a little bit about the stories he gets from the students and how that connects with what you found when you were teaching people who had had really interesting lives, but that wasn't what was coming back at you at the stories that we're writing.
Well, what happens is that, you know, when you're trying to get kids to write, or trying to get anybody to write who's not a serious writer, rather than think about what's meaningful to them, they try to anticipate what would be meaningful to you. And so the source is always coming from the outside. What does this guy want to hear? What'll get me an A? How do I get this homework assignment as quick as I can? And the irony is that, you know, so they go to television for their stories, or they go to sort of crummy books that they've read, you know, for ideas, when in fact, you know, there's diamonds in the backyard. The minutiae of their everyday life is where all the jewels are. And repeatedly, I've had to sit kids down and say, why are you writing this? Tell me about yourself. Tell me, your father's a black fireman in a white suburban town? Well, why on earth are you writing about people sniffing angel dust in the South Bronx where you've never been?
Ray is separated from his wife. And
right.
When he comes back to New Jersey, he hooks up with his daughter again. But he's very self-conscious around her and realizes he's treating her like a first date. What gave you that image?
Oh, I got a couple of daughters. I use them for practice. it's just, you know, I find myself, I mean, sometimes with my kids, the bad parent part of me is the part of me that feels like it's running for office and needs their votes and sort of like can cater, you know, to what they would like as opposed to doing the more difficult stuff, which is to say, no, you can't do that. You know, and there's a certain weakness in me that I have to fight to be a parent. I mean, it's, you know, it's a big, you know, cliche to say, you know, don't be a friend, be a parent. You know, there's plenty of time for friendship when they turn adult themselves. Right now, they need yes and no. They need guidance, you know. And but basically, I have to struggle with the fact that what I really want them to do is adore me. You know, and I'm running for office, you know, and I catch myself and I'll pull back, but it's hard work.
There's a scene where Ray takes his daughter, his 13-year-old daughter, to the shopping mall and tells her, today a penny's, today a dollar's like a penny. You can spend anything, you can buy anything. And he expects he's really going to be a hero to her, but she gets really angry and sullen and kind of throws on the floor the things that he's bought her. What's that about?
It's about how easy it is to us underestimate the perceptiveness and intelligence of children and how they can read you like a comic book and have been all their lives if they're yours. And any kid, if not, you know, even if they're not able to put it in words, knows exactly the weaknesses of their parents and knows exactly the strengths of their parents. And it so rarely has anything to do with what comes out of the parents' mouth. I mean, you know, I've been in therapy for, I think, 3,427 years. You know, I've put 11 shrinks kids through Bennington already, I think. But, you know, and so when I'm talking to my kids, I know exactly what to say to sound, you know, like, you know, sharing and caring and, you know, saying, making the right noises and this and that. But I think what the kids do is they smell you. They don't even listen to what's coming out of your mouth. They look you right in the eye or they arch their nostrils and they know what you really want, what you really value, what you really need. So this daughter would know that Ray, if the easiest way for Ray to be giving is to give something, to literally, and they're in the mall, which is the crucible. And the kid flips out. She doesn't want any more belly button rings. She doesn't want any more, like, skin lotion. She doesn't want anything. She just wants him to shut the hell up.
Now, you know, Ray gets this terrible head injury. He's hit over the head with a vase. And, you know, who did it and why they did it is the mystery in the book. Usually in detective stories, the detective gets hit over the head, usually with a gun. He's knocked unconscious, and he awakes with a terrible headache that goes away in a few hours. Whereas, you know, Ray he's in serious jeopardy after getting knocked on the head with his vase. And the jeopardy continues because the headaches can come back. There can be long-term consequences. I was wondering if you were thinking a lot about how different a concussion can be in real life from the way it usually is in crime fiction.
Not really. I mean, I was basically thinking of, you know, I just went to a couple of doctor people, friends that I know, and said, give me a real bad concussion. You know, which they proceeded to do. I just wanted enough to know. I mean, basically, the pain that Ray has to live with and the tentativeness of his recovery, he's been taught a lesson. He knows who did this to him, and he knows that down the line it could cost him his life or it could cost him the use of the right side of his body or something like that. And he doesn't want revenge. He doesn't want this person arrested. He's learned something. And what's driving the detective crazy is that there's a certain amount of shame in what he's learned, and that's why he's not telling her. He's protecting somebody, and what she's picking up from him is shame. And when a detective picks up reticence in a victim, they're thinking that here's a person who's more afraid of the truth coming out than of getting justice. That means that this person is hiding something pretty bad. So, of course, the first thing she thinks of has to do with deviant sexuality, pederasty, drug habit, gambling addictions. She goes through a whole checklist of reasons why people would rather live, you know, with their injury, you know, than see justice sought. But it's something greater and more subtle than any of that. And each book is supposed to be about the education of a character. Well, I mean, they both become educated during the course of the investigation.
Now, I think you're in the process of writing a screen adaptation of your new novel, Samaritan, yes?
Not if I can help it. I'm supposed to. To write a script of your own book, I always say it's like just because you're a dentist, that doesn't mean you have to do your own root canal. I mean, it's a nightmare. You have to sort of debride and tear apart this thing, and you know every word of the 400 pages, and your job now is you got to make it into a 110-page singing telegram, and it's all like going up into the attic to find something when you open up a book, you know, to find material to write a screenplay. You come down 3 days later with a whalebone corset on, all your old baseball cards, you know, and your great Aunt Fanny's hat. And you now have a 9,000-page screenplay because it's your book and you love every word and you just can't do it. You don't have the discipline. You're not ruthless enough.
So you're not going to do it yourself? You're going to have somebody
I'm supposed to do it myself. I'm scheming to, like, try to convince the producer to give it to somebody else and let me write a second original. If I have to, I will, but I'd rather not. Life's too short.
Were you happy with the Clockers adaptation?
Not really. I mean, there were very good things in it. I mean, Spike Lee is an artist. He's a terrific visual artist, and there was a terrific visuality to it. There were some wonderful things in some of the performances. By and large, it's not the movie that I would have made, but then again, I'm not a filmmaker.
So was the adaptation that was used one that you had written?
Well, it's what I had written and what Spike rewrote. He wrote on top of me. And there was an interesting thing. He said something to me. I had seen his draft of my draft, and I was horrified. And I said, told him so. I just said, this is like cheesecloth. I mean, there's nothing here. And he said to me, and I've never forgotten this, he said, Richard, you're a writer, you're a screenwriter. When you're done with this script, you're gone from the film project. So you put in everything but the kitchen sink. It's like leaving notes all over, for the cleaning lady. You know, do this, do that, right before you, and you're gone. Me, when I write this, I'm the director, so the script is basically notes to myself. I don't have to show this to a director. I am the director. All I need to write down is things I don't want to forget.
When was the last time you picked up one of your early novels, The Wanderer's Ladies' Man, even The Breaks?
When was the last time?
Mm-hmm.
Never. All I see when I look back at this stuff I've written, especially before Clockers, is what I got away with. You know, I never see anything. I'm reading this stuff, and I can't see how it got published. All I can see is the mistakes I've made, which is probably okay. If I thought that this is as good as it's going to get, then I haven't learned anything. But now that my kids are, you know, teenagers, they've both read a few books of mine, and when I was writing these books, I was in my early 20s. The idea of having children is I might as well be a cowboy or something. It just seemed like science fiction to me to have children, you know, when I was writing. And now all of a sudden I've got kids that are about 5 or 6 years younger than I was when I wrote The Wanderers, and they're starting to read it, and they look to see where I am, and they have to read it on the slide, because if I know that they're reading it, I'm going to sneak up behind them and start screaming out, don't read that paragraph. I didn't know you were going to read that someday. You know, because there's all this, like, you know, perversity in it, which, you know, when I wrote it, was just exuberance. But now I've, you know, my own kids are reading this, and it's mortifying. And they both say, Dad, go away. You go read Stephen Crane or something. I am going to read this book. Okay? I'm not going to tell you when I'm reading this book. If I see you coming, I'm going to put the book down. And I go, okay, I'm leaving. And then I, like, sort of crawl back into the bedroom through the other way, sneak up behind them and try to peek over their shoulder and see what part they're at. And next thing you know, my hand comes across over their shoulder. It's like, don't read that page, and I have a heart attack because they didn't know I was in the room. I mean, it's a wonderful thing. It's like, you know, I have a 16-year-old daughter who's reading Samaritan now, and she doesn't read an awful lot. You know, she's a good writer, and she reads what she reads, but, you know, reading is not one of her major pastimes. And she just said, hey, Dad, you're like a really good writer, you know, and it just felt so nice that she said that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Price, and his new novel is called Samaritan. Do you go back to your old neighborhood much?
Well, I went back to my old neighborhood. That's how this book started. I went back to the projects in the Bronx, and I went back with this detective who I based the Nerys Ammons character on, because this was the extreme corner of her precinct's jurisdiction.
So this would be the projects in the Bronx where you grew up that The Wanderers is based on, which is your novel about street gangs in the South Bronx.
Right. I mean, and I went back. But, you know, the thing is, you can spend your whole life writing about the same people and the same things, and it's okay. You don't have to go anywhere else, because what changes is you. And it's basically a lifetime of refining a vision. I mean, I would never, you know, put myself in the same category as Faulkner, but I mean, obviously, he's the example everybody brings up, that little county in Mississippi. For me, it would be the Parkside Projects in the Bronx. The bricks will stay the same. I'm the thing that's going to change.
Well, not only have you changed when you go back to the projects where you grew up, the projects have changed. I'm sure the neighborhoods changed, the people living in the projects have changed. What are some of the ways
that was the
changed?
Big shock about Clockers, which is that I'd grown up in the projects, but I'd grown up at a time in the 50s and the early 60s. It was before drugs and before Vietnam, and people stayed there because it was clean, good, affordable housing, and you could save money to send the next generation on to college so that generation wouldn't have to return to the projects. And that all changed in the late 60s and early 70s. And when I had gone from The Wanderers, which was about the projects in the 60s, and all of a sudden it's the 1980s, and I'm doing research for Sea of Love, the Al Pacino movie, and I go with a bunch of cops back to a housing project in Jersey City, which is very much, you know, architecturally at any rate, like the projects that I had grown up in, except it was a place that it looked like hell. I felt like I was in a tiger pit. I'd never seen anything so dire and desperate in my life. And I found myself wanting so badly to understand what happened in this project, or trying to reconnect to this project, and that's what Clockers came out of. But it's just ironic. It's like I've been writing for 30 years, and it seems like I started out with housing projects, and I'm still back at the original project that The Wanderers came out of.
You know, in your early novels, like The Wanderers, The Breaks, Blood Brothers, it was easy to see the main character as being your surrogate. In your later novels, like Freedomland and Clockers, it didn't seem to really be directly about you in any way, although I'm sure there are experiences based on ones you had. But in your new novel, Samaritan, it's easy to see Ray as a character who shares some of the experiences that you had as being, in some level or another, like your surrogate. Do you feel like you took a break from yourself and then came back to yourself?
Yeah, well,
again?
What happened is, you know, my first four books in some way were self-referential, and there I was, like 32 years old, with four autobiographies. I mean, even my therapist was going into a coma, you know. And so I just had to stop, and that's why I got into screenwriting, because I wanted to keep writing, but I just didn't want to have to keep writing about myself. Became a hired pen, and for all the bad things you can say about Hollywood, it did teach me that I can write about people that are not me, and, you know, pull it off. So I did that for 8 years, and when I got back to novels, you know, I still was afraid of going back into examining my own navel. But, you know, I got, for personal reasons, got involved in the world of, you know, Clockers and Freedomland, where there was nobody like me. Samaritan is sort of like a return to thinking about myself a little bit, because I think it's safe now. So, I mean, 20-odd years have passed. And, you know, like I said, I've been married that time. I have two children. I didn't have any kids. And I think my life has changed enough that I feel like I have some things to say that are clean and fresh, at least about myself, to myself. And I think, once again, I feel a little bit like I am valid grounds for literature again, hopefully.
But writing about a character like yourself, when you have a wife and children, can be complex, too, because they might see some of the characters as being similar to them, or they might see some of your character's thoughts as being like your thoughts. And here's like a sensitive one. Your character's thinking about the difficulty of remaining monogamous in marriage, because you get to know the other person's body so well. It's kind of like making love to yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not something a wife would really want to read.
Well, but, you know, it's, you know, hey, I mean, they do call it fiction. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
You know, somebody knows you. Help. I mean, somebody, you know, listen, somebody knows you.
Exactly.
And they know what
right.
you do for a living.
Exactly.
And they know what it's like to be with you, and they know how you feel about them. And you would hope that they can read something, be they your spouse or your kids, and know what artistic license is.
Right. Well, Richard Price, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Novelist and screenwriter Richard Price speaking with Terry Gross. His novel Samaritan comes out in paperback next week.